Hello, and thanks for listening and coming with me as we explore the human side and impact of crime. And just a couple of things I'd like to ask you to consider. Firstly, my guests share their personal stories, which others may see differently. No one will see a situation the same. It's just human nature. Secondly, my podcasts aren't suitable for children and some adults for that matter, so please consider if it's right for you and contact Lifeline or any other support service if you find yourself affected by my subject matter. Oh, and don't forget, my next show is at the State Library of Victoria on Saturday the 25th of June with undercover cop Keith Banks. I reckon you'll think twice about trusting anybody after listening to Keith. Tickets are through Eventbrite. Thanks.
And that's why a lot of disgruntled police, even serving police, one of the common phrases they will use is, well, they don't care about us. They is that faceless entity of the police force. They don't care about us. And it really needs to be changed. It really does.
Keith Banks is an author of two very successful books, Drugs, Guns and Lies and Gun to the Head, where he talks about his life as an undercover cop and later as a tactical special weapons operator. They're fascinating reads, but both books left me wondering about the price that police pay to catch the bad guys. So why do we do it? What is it that drives us to constantly put ourselves in danger? Where we're criticised by the public at times for our lack of action or other times for our overzealous action, but worse, we can be criticised by the very people who employ and train us. Keith Banks joined the Queensland Police Academy as a 16-year-old in 1975, wanting to protect those in abusive households and to fight the drug trade, which he saw as an immense evil. Keith was an innocent, non-drinking, idealistic young recruit. By the age of 22, he'd become an undercover, what we call a UC. But by the time he left undercover 2 years later, he was a binge drinker who smoked dope with criminals and friends alike. Keith resigned from the police force in 1995, disillusioned, hypersensitive, guilt-ridden, distrusting, sad, angry, and racked with PTSD. Keith paid a huge price for trying to protect us and to keep us safe, and along the way, he lost a couple of very dear colleagues to a darkness that they just couldn't escape from. Like so many first responders, Keith never thought of the impact crime would have on his mental health and kept either making excuses or ignoring what was happening inside his head, which presumably had been bubbling away for years. Keith fought much of his psychological demons on his own, with little support and virtually trusting no one with the truth of how he was really feeling. In hindsight, I wondered whether Keith would do it again. Anyway, let's ask him along the way somewhere, but thanks for your time today, Keith.
Good morning, Noelle.
And good morning. And before we start, I think we'd better tell the listeners about our show on June the 25th at the State Library, 7 p.m. Tickets through Eventbrite. What can the audience expect on that night, Keith?
Oh, look, I'm really looking forward to it, Narelle. The audience can expect an authentic conversation about undercover work, about deep undercover work. Lots of lovely people have seen a lot of movies and television, and I guess they have an image of what it's like to be undercover and how glamorous it is, and the truth is far from that. So they can expect me to talk about a couple of operations I've been in, probably from go to woe. One in particular I haven't written about, so for those who've read the book, it will be new. And really just, you know, an open conversation with you about the impact of that sort of life on young people.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to it because we've spoken before, obviously, and you said that I think a lot of people would be interested in the go from go to woe, like how the job comes in, who's picked for how a UC is picked and, you know, what you have to do or prepare to be involved in such an operation. Because I've only really ever in my career, I was only ever part of an operation once where I sought the services, I suppose, of a UC, and that was a one-off. But yours were like you were another person for years, not just a once off, were you?
Oh, absolutely right. Yeah, I was. In fact, four different people. I had four different identities, four different false identities, bank accounts and driver's licenses. And in fact, I had a passport in one of them as well. And yeah, because it was pretty easy to get ID in those, or to get passports in those days, you know, that before the whole 100 points of proof thing. Same as opening a bank account, all you needed was a driver's license, and I had four of those that were fake. So, yeah, I mean, living that life, I look back on it now in hindsight and shudder, to be honest. But when you're young, 10 foot tall and bulletproof, you know, and you're living that life, it's such a rush. And I've spoken about in both of my books how the rush and the adrenaline, you just can't recapture. And that becomes very addictive. And as I'm fond of saying, men's brains, according to the medical profession, don't mature until they're 26. I was 22, as were my friends. And, of course, my wife would say that my brain doesn't mature at all.
Oh, God, love her. Yeah.
But see, at that stage, we were
I'm not going anywhere near that. I'll stay away from that.
I'll let people judge for themselves when they actually buy our tickets and turn up. How's that for a hook? But, you know, when you're in the middle of it, you actually just really didn't like the downtime between jobs, unless it had been a horrible job. And one I'll talk about on the night really affected me deeply. But others, you know, you'd finish the job, you'd be given another job elsewhere, you know, outside the city, or if we'd been in North Queensland, back on the Gold Coast or something, because our identities were disclosed after every operation. And it's really interesting. I'll be careful what I say, but I met a current covert or young guy who just finished covert in Brisbane when I was up there doing some research for another book. And I had some beers with him, and it still happens up there. They still get their identities disclosed, not their real identities, but it is still told to the offenders that they've been dealing with an undercover cop, which I just find bizarre. But anyway.
Do they have to do that? Is that a legal requirement?
I think it's more just a procedural and operational one.
Oh, my God, how dangerous.
Yeah, exactly. It was dangerous enough 40 years ago, that's frightening, when I was doing it.
Oh, my God, Keith. Yeah.
It was frightening enough then, but now that it still continues, I looked at him and I won't use the language I used, but I said, oh, my goodness gracious, that's amazing.
I've never heard you talk so nicely when you're trying to swear.
I'm trying to modify my image. But, yeah, it's just astounding. But so back to that, you know, when you're doing it all, it's exciting, it's different, you know, and the thing about undercover work was, and I let's be honest, you know, I'd had, 2 years in the academy as a cadet. I'd been then in uniform in various areas, and you know, the haircut regulations, and I hated the haircuts. Haircut regulations. Loved wearing the uniform because I thought you needed to look really good in it, so I was always sharp. And but you know, if you didn't have your hat on, you'd be yelled at and screamed at. If you you know, got out of the car without your tunic buttoned up all the way, you'd be yelled at. All that sort of stuff. Told when to take your meal break, blah, blah, blah. So undercover, living it, carrying a gun all the time, you know, living the identity all the time was really appealing because no haircuts, put an earring in, do whatever the hell you – look how any way you wanted to, you know, dependent on the cover that you had, of course. But we just – we just lived a life that was totally outside the boundaries and the rules in many ways. So that was pretty addictive in itself.
God, yeah. And you just said then that you had four different identities and maybe on the night we might go over that a bit because that's so interesting just in itself.
Sure.
But do you ever find yourself going back to that identity and thinking, oh, I'm not him anymore?
Oh, look, I and again, it's one of the chats I'll want to have on the night, but I came through pretty much okay. You know, I had a major lifestyle change, but when I left undercover, I wasn't bad. I took a little time to assimilate back into the real world, but I had friends of mine who were damaged. Oh, God, you know, I had Harry, who developed a heroin addiction, Spider, who developed a major psychological addiction to cannabis, Larry, who did it for way too long and he just could not go back to the real world. You know, I used to talk about, and I think I did mention in my first book somewhere, that my analogy was that we were like scuba divers who came back to the surface too quickly. You come back to the surface too quickly, you develop the bends. And for a lot of the boys, and probably me as well, you know, I bought an ounce of heroin one afternoon in a Bai Bus, and the very next morning I went to a hairdresser, got my hair cut, put my uniform on, went to work, and was sitting in a uniform patrol car going, wow, this is different.
It is just a little bit, yeah.
Yeah, and as silly as it sounds, I remember looking at the microphone on the dashboard thinking, now I know I've got to pick it up and use it, but I can't bloody remember what I'm supposed to say. And so that was a bit different. But, no, I really enjoyed the method acting part of it, Narelle. So, you know, as I said, I'm going to talk on the night about something that affected me deeply. But generally I was all right. My mates, not so much.
I suppose you'd have to be a very good actor, wouldn't you? Like, have you ever thought about being an actor? Like, because you'd obviously be a good one because you can be so many different people.
Well, you know what? Yes. But I just never followed that up, of course. But I reckon, you know, it would be an apologies to any actors listening if they think that I'm telling their craft is easy, because it's not. But you're right, having acted in the real world and acted in a way that you come up with excuses very quickly, you know, that you've got to think on your feet and you've got to be a character, yeah, and you've got to push back and you've got to all manner of things. And funnily enough, a quick side thing, when we in Queensland actually started training our undercovers, there were no training courses when I did it. I was one of the first instructors on what was called the Covert Police Officer CPO course, and it was all boys. Men at that stage. They started bringing women in later, maybe the late 80s. But I was running a course, and of course you had all of these, you know, what if questions.
Oh yeah.
And because I had done it in real life, it was fairly simple for me to go, okay, I would do this, I would say that. And at the end of the course, they gave me a little presentation thing, which was Banksy, the man of 1,000 answers. I've still got it somewhere.
I love it, yeah.
Because that's what you have to do. You know, you have to immerse yourself in the role of who you are, and you have to act accordingly. You know, there was I've got many, many, many stories, but one, for instance, sorry, a quick one, was a guy I've written about in the first book who, you know, spoiler alert, was planning to kill me. I thought we were friends. And he was telling me and my – actually worked with a colleague on this one, Larry, telling us about how he'd been in jail, you know, and what happens in jail and all of that stuff. And we were sitting there and our cover was that I was a freelance journo. Larry was my photographer and we were squareheads, as criminals call us, clean, you know, normal people. And
clean skins.
Clean skins, yeah. And we were up there doing a tourist piece, you know, freelance tourist piece. And so we're sitting there, you know, go, oh, my God, is that right? Wow. Wide-eyed, you know, playing the part of the innocent, naive blokes, when both of us probably knew more than he did. So it's not always portraying a hard, tough dealer. Sometimes you play that role.
Fascinating.
Any Crawford Productions out there, let me know.
I don't think Homicide or else was there? Division 4.
Oh, yes, yes.
Skippy. there you go. Look, there's still hope for you, Keith. Well, hey, listen, we'd better not talk too much about your undercover, because nobody will come on the 25th.
Oh, they will. I guarantee it.
Yeah, you're right. Hey, so Keith, after your 20 years in some of, oh, you could only call them like a dangerous situation, is putting it mildly. As an undercover cop, was there a situation or a time when you decided, you know, maybe I should seek some professional advice about your psychological health, or didn't that even come into your,
yeah,
your thinking?
Didn't even come into my thinking for two reasons, I guess. One is I didn't think I had any, I was affected by it. I knew my lifestyle had changed. I knew I was smoking a lot of weed and I was drinking a lot and I was, you know, a different guy. But, and the second reason is it didn't really exist. You know, the culture back in the 80s, I guess across society as well, not just the cops, was that psychiatrists were only really for nutcases, you know. So, you know, there was no such – there wasn't even a conversation about you need to have some therapy or you need to have some support. It was, oh, they go to a shrink, they must be mental. It is exactly the way the attitude was. So, you know, even my mates who were damaged, you know, they – there was no, there's not even, it wasn't even in our thought process to seek support.
And did you not think that you were damaged or that being in this lifestyle is going to change me and, you know, my mind isn't what it used to be? Like, it just didn't enter your head.
Yeah. Oh, look, I knew it had changed personally. I knew it had changed me. But again, that young male thinking, the idealistic attitude, yeah. Oh, well, it had to happen for me to be successful at my job as a UC. So, you know, it was almost like, oh, well, that's just the price we pay. If I do remember having the chat with a couple of the boys, oh, you know, maybe in 30 years if we're bosses somewhere and, you know, we've got some issues, then we could probably sue the department. But it was more in a joking way. It was never a serious conversation. Mm. And again, as males, one of the big failings that males had and still do have, in some extent, to some extent, is they're not honest about how they feel. You know, so we were still alpha males. And I just thought, oh, well, that's a part of my life. I loved it. I broke some rules, you know, blah, blah, blah. Now I'll move on to the next stage of my life. It was only years later that I crashed and I left. And then years later I realized I was broken. You know, I had all of those symptoms when I resigned. But that was a long time after undercover. But again, it's a whole nother conversation because I actually just thought it was me. I thought I was, to be honest, I thought I was overreacting. Yep. You know?
Yeah, yeah. And I think you've said before that you weren't diagnosed with PTSD until 2019.
That's right.
That's
yeah.
Something like what, 30 years later or something. It's
yeah,
huge.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you're right, it's bizarre, isn't it? You know,
it is bizarre, and that sort of brings me to my next question.
Sure.
So did you have any psych tests prior to becoming a UC? Like, did you have to be a certain type of person? Did they test you in any way?
No, they do now.
I gather by that laugh that means no.
No, that's a no. Undercover in my day was quite literally, I went to an inspector, a uniform inspector who I trusted who had been a detective, and said, boss, I want to talk about how I become an undercover agent. He looked at me, he said, yeah, you'd probably be all right. So
that was the tick, yeah.
And he rang his contact at the drug squad. I went in and had a chat with the senior sergeant. And I was a baby-faced little guy. And we had the chat and I was all, you know, idealistic and I want to save the world. And he must have thought, yeah, okay, well, we'll get you in because you don't look like a copper. And that was it. So there was there was certainly no psychological testing, nothing at all. And that was the way that pretty much all the police forces operated in those days, except for New Zealand. New Zealand were years ahead of us. And I only realised that later when I was a sergeant working in the intelligence and covert surveillance area, as I worked on biker gangs and I had a great contact in New Zealand. And we talked about all of this. He said, oh, yeah, mate. He said, you know, we psychologically tested our undercovers going back to the early 80s. We transitioned them back. You know, we had a whole debrief for them. I was thinking, wow, wow. But, no, most police forces, nah. They just threw young kids, sometimes straight from the academy, but they threw young kids into undercover because they just didn't look like coppers, and that was the only litmus test.
God, so you obviously would never have been warned about the possible psychological side effects?
No, the short answer is no. You know, I remember I spoke to, I was still in uniform when I was doing all of this, you know, I want to be an undercover. And there was a guy who sadly has passed away now, but he came back and he'd spent about 2 years undercover as well. And he came back in uniform and he was telling me about an instance. He was in a house. There were three big Samoan boys that he was buying drugs from. One of them recognized him and recognized him as a cop. And he had to try and fight his way out, and he had to pull his gun out and shoot one of them through the hand and then ran out of the house with a broken jaw and so on. And I'm thinking, wow. And I said, so where was your backup? And he just laughed at me. And I understood later why he laughed at me, because there was no such thing as a backup.
Oh, it's almost laughable, but it's not. It's just, yeah. But then again, as we keep saying, this was way back in the, what was it, the late 70s, early 80s.
Yeah.
Is that, yeah. And it was a different world. Like when I joined in 87, it was a different world back then. Yeah. And I suppose that you just accepted that's what it is. That's my job.
Oh, yeah, exactly right. You know, even the smoking dope thing. When I was first in a position where I was doing that, I remember thinking, now I know this is against the law, but obviously it's condoned because I'm an undercover cop. No one actually ever said you're permitted to do it. They gave you as much weed as you wanted. It's a whole different story. But but it was never formally condoned. It was one of those bizarre unspoken
bizarre things. Bizarre is putting it mildly. Yep. So do you now think, and I think from what you said then about New Zealand UCs, do you think that UCs should be periodically psychologically assessed or reassessed during their tenure as a UC?
Without doubt. I think I think there should be a psychological touch base point probably every at least a quarter. Just to see how it's going, because, you know, it's not only a legal requirement for police departments, services, forces, whatever the verbiage is, to look after their people. It's also a humanitarian one, you know, and you're putting people in a position where often now they're unarmed, they still work alone, they have more coverage, and I'm being careful what I say, but they have more coverage than they used to, but you're still dealing with criminals and you're still portraying yourself as a criminal. And that does have, without doubt, it has a psychological impact. I do know I tend to make light of it, but I look back in hindsight and think, my good God, you know, I was a kid and I was in bikie clubhouses. I was in, you know, drug dealers' places and no one ever knew really where we were. There were no mobiles or pages or tracking devices. We were just out there somewhere. And
even if you had them, you would never have worn them, because somebody just has to find one.
Yeah.
Or suspect you've got one on you, and you.
Well, the only
good night, Irene.
Exactly right. You know, I remember I had arguments with particular people who wanted me to wear a recording device, and I went, my goodness gracious, no, I'm not going to. Because, you know, it wasn't uncommon for drug dealers to say, get your gear off, I just want to see if you're wired. And, of course, then you'd get offended and, you know, push, shove, scream, yell, but ultimately you'd do it. And then there'd be a whole different conversation. You know, don't you trust me, blah, blah, blah. But,
yeah.
And the technology in those days wasn't great anyway, but
no,
it was just, and at that tender age, doing what we were doing, for me personally, it gave me a lot more self-confidence, and the other side of the coin was a lot more arrogance, you know. So I didn't put up with dickheads anymore, you know. I used to, but I didn't put up with them. And I'm talking about in the police force.
Yeah.
You know, as we've talked.
There's a few of them.
Oh, yeah.
That hasn't changed.
Well, you know, I've had this conversation with various people. In my opinion, just lived experience, in policing you meet the best people in the world or the biggest dickheads, and there seems to be no grey area in between. But that's
– You're right.
Yeah. You know, and
I'd have to say the majority are 98%. of the people I met in policing were salt of the earth, just fantastic people. But gee, that 2%. Oh,
the troublesome 2%. You're right.
Oh, gee. Hey, so during your years in UC, if an option was ever offered to you for, say, a periodical psych assessment, do you reckon you would have considered it, or you would have said, come on, you know, goodness gracious me, off you go?
Good question. I guess thinking back to how I was, I would have accepted it on the condition that no one else knew that I'd accepted it. So I would have liked to have known how I was going, but I wouldn't have wanted my mates to see me.
There's that stigma again, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, I don't want to be talking to anybody about that fluffy, touchy-feely stuff.
that's right. Well, or be seen to be doing it. The other challenge is, you know, as you know, later in my career, I've been in gunfights, I've been in situations that were quite life-threatening, very life-threatening, and so on. Even then, a psychologist who is appointed by the police department, the challenge that he or she has is that cops find it very difficult to speak with them because the psychologist has never experienced life on the street in those situations. Whilst they have theoretical knowledge, etc., cops are very, as you know, Nirol, we're very insular, we're very territorial, we are distrustful of others, and also we know that other people don't see what we see. So there's the challenge with psychologists, and, you know, maybe that's why I wasn't diagnosed until many years later, because I didn't probably really find one that I liked enough, to be honest with.
Mm. You know? And I think also, you know, and again, this is for another day, but I also think the only time a psychologist or a psychiatrist or any mental health expert will work is when you accept that you are damaged and you are prepared to accept help. Because I found that the hardest, to accept that I had a, quote, mental illness, unquote. And until you actually accept that you're not right, you'll never get better.
Yeah, I totally agree. And removing the stigma. So one of my passions is talking openly and authentically to people about my mental illness, injury, whatever we want to term it. Because to me, it's the same as breaking your leg. If you break your leg, there's a treatment. If your brain is injured through trauma, which it has been for both you and me and many, many thousands of others, then there's treatment available. And it should be perceived in the same way by those who aren't injured, but really importantly by those who are, you know. And there's a lot of work that still has to be done in that space. But you're spot on. Once you realise, shit, I do have some problems. It was very empowering for me to be diagnosed, to be honest.
Likewise.
I walked out of my shrink's office and went, wow, I haven't been imagining it. Whew, right. It was almost like a sigh of relief, you know. And let's now fix it.
Yeah, amazing. Mm. Couldn't agree more. Debriefs, I want to have a bit of a chat about them. Mm. What are your thoughts on the way that police in general conduct debriefs? Back in your day, talking as a UC.
Oh, look, we were – the debrief was always about drinking beer with the arrest teams, and they were telling each other how great they were, congratulating themselves on the arrest they'd made as a result of what we did. You know, it was appalling. There was one job I did on the Gold Coast. I'd gone back to the drug squad as a detective, and morning drug raids, you know, I can't, maybe 100 people arrested for heroin, whatever, heroin dealing and so on. And at the end of the day, as we used to do, we've all gone back to the hotel, and we were staying one of those bloody resort, not resorts, but, you know, the tall accommodation things on the coast. And the drug squad were all, there was a 3 or 4 bedroom unit on one floor and then another floor, and they're all on the gas. And I don't know where I was. I'd finished processing someone at the watch house, I think, and came back, and they're all drinking and go, oh, great day. And I said, so where's the UC? I don't know. He's upstairs, I think. So I went up to the UC's room, this really cool bloke called Dan, and he was maybe 7 floors above them, knocked on the door. He went, oh, g'day, mate. And I said, you by yourself? He said, yeah. I said, well, you're not anymore. So I went in and spent the evening with him and just, you know, congratulating him and then seeing how he was going. And because I'd been there. But the rest of them, because they'd never worked in an undercover capacity, and I think a lot of the attitude was that, oh, well, there are UCs are out there paid to smoke dope. They just do the how hard can it be? And that was the mentality. So the debriefs were appalling. Later in that space, I started controlling undercover operations. So, you know, so I was the contact. I was the one who ran the strategy, all that stuff. And I looked after my people because I knew how I hadn't been looked after. So there was an evolutionary change there. But, yeah, geez, generally, no, pretty bad.
I'd have to, and the only reason I ask that is because I can only ever remember debriefs. I didn't find it was the type of environment which encouraged members to actually voice their concerns or their struggles. Mm-hmm. And I think my own view was I just thought they were conducted to tick a box.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which is probably wrong, but I'm wondering, was there ever any debrief, and that's whether you're a UC or a detective or a senior connie or whatever, were you ever part of any debrief that you found beneficial that you can recall?
Ah, let me think. And the fact that I have to think about it just probably means no.
Oh, gee.
You know,
yeah.
And you're right. I think it was there to tick a box, Narelle. One that still makes me incredibly angry, or even all these years later, was I went to a job where a young policeman had been shot at point blank by an offender who'd killed his baby daughter, shot his wife, shot her new partner, and Brett and his partner turned up. And as he got out of the car, he was shot point blank through the chest and died. And my tactical team and I went in, and we went in, and the offender had killed himself, unfortunately. So that night, or that afternoon, we were told to attend a debrief. So it probably would have been about 6 or 7 at night in the local police station. We thought, okay, this will be a positive step. So myself and my tactical team were all lined up down the back in our blacks, and, you know, they had the uniformed police there from the station Brett had been at. They had the detectives. They had, you know, public servants. And I remember thinking, oh, this is a nice change. You know, this is going to be a conversation about how we're all going. The assistant commissioner stood up. Brett had been murdered probably 5 hours before, and this assistant commissioner couldn't even remember his name. He turned. He said, "Oh, we're here to talk about the death of what's his name." And I just. I was actually, I had so much anger then. I was on my way to getting up to my feet, and two of my boys grabbed each arm and just kept me where I was because they knew I would have just gone off. And, you know, so ticking a box, self-aggrandizement, you know, who the heck knows?
See, I feel that debrief, that's too soon in my view. I think debriefs can be very beneficial. I'm yet to go to one that I thought was a good one, mind you, but I think they can be like, that's too soon. People need time to absorb what's happened, to get their own mind around things, like to actually have a debrief. And do you think that was a debrief, or was that more just getting the crews together and just saying, come on, you know, we've all done a good job? You know, there's a big difference, isn't there, between a formal debrief and, like, look, you know, I'm just going to say what the assistant commissioner said, you know, what's his name?
Yeah.
You know, it's terrible that he's been murdered, but, like, yeah, I think debriefs should be held maybe a week later or maybe, and I think they probably are, that's too soon.
Oh, look, and it was appallingly handled. And you're right, debriefs should be an initial, you know, an initial chat with the crew, particularly in shootings, you know, because you've got to go through a homicide bloody investigation, interviews and all of that stuff.
Enormous.
Then there should be an initial one, like a welfare check, and then a week later to say, okay, let's just sit down as a group and individually and just do a welfare check and say, how are you going? Tell me what it was like. You need an operational debrief to learn from.
Because absolutely.
There's an old saying, the best battle plan only lasts until contact with the enemy. In other words, everything goes to shit. You need to have all of that. But, you know, from a human perspective, no, there was no other conversation with us after that night.
Oh, that's
true. You know, and I won't give you the graphic details, but if people read read my second book, I've written about it, finding the offender and all that sort of stuff. And there was nothing. Mm. And we just went, oh, well, that's, you know. And that's why a lot of disgruntled police, even serving police, one of the common phrases they will use is, well, they don't care about us. Who's they? They is that faceless entity of the police force. They don't care about us. And it really needs to be changed. It really does.
Yeah, yeah. And in one way, we are putting the boots in. But in another way, I've also found probably the best debriefing I've had in any major incident I've been involved, which is nothing like yours, but it's more the friends or the colleagues that will say, hey, Fraze, what are you up to? Let's go out. You know, can you believe that? Let's go. And so you do it personally, like just with one-on-one sort of, whereas if you do a debrief in a group, I don't know about you, but I don't know many police that would ever stand up in a formal debrief and talk about how it has affected them emotionally. It just doesn't happen. But some of the best debriefs I've ever had are with my colleagues, and there are so many that cared one-on-one. But as a organisation, I think they have a lot to learn about supporting, you know, each other through something really horrific.
Yeah, yeah. Look, you always, I couldn't agree more, I always had support of my friends, as in my work colleagues and friends, whether it be over 45 beers or whether it not, it was, you know, you're more able to talk to your friends. And you're right, because, again, going back to that alpha male and alpha female culture, you know, we're out there engaging with some pretty bad crooks, and the crooks don't have rules. We do. So to stand up in front of a group and go, yeah, I'm struggling a bit, wouldn't happen. Would never happen.
And I don't know, but and it's been a long time since I've been there, but I still doubt that you would have somebody stand up. And I hope I'm wrong, but I don't think we've come a long way, but I don't think we've come quite that far yet.
No.
You witnessed a lot of corruption in your years, particularly with the drug squad and as a UC. So what advice would you give to anyone listening who suspects, and I'm probably talking more police here, but, you know, corruption happens in all different workplaces, but what sort of advice would you give anyone listening who suspects that there is some type of corruption happening in their particular world?
So my immediate thought on that is that there's a saying I love, and the saying is, the situation you walk by is the situation you accept, right?
Yes.
So if you ignore it, that means you're accepting it. And I always, I've broken a hell of a lot of rules. You know, I would have been a nightmare to manage as a cop. But I've never been a crook. I've never been corrupt. And in my view, anybody in policing who was corrupt, and by that I mean taking payoffs, stealing property, stealing money, not doing their job for bribes, all of that stuff is criminal in my opinion. And if they did that, they spat on their badge. So for me, they no longer had my loyalty. And I think from a cultural perspective, there's still a thing with police where they go, oh, I'm not going to lag on my mates. But what you walk by is what you accept. And what people should do is think long and hard about, first of all, not getting involved in it, having the ability to say no, and then secondly, explore what options there are in their organisations to report it, because, you know, we need to get over that old Australian attitude of don't be a dobber. If people are operating in an environment where they affect your integrity as a member of an organisation, they need to be held accountable for it.
But wouldn't you agree that some people ignore corruption, or they don't do anything about it there's lots of reasons. Maybe they might, I don't know, lose their job. Maybe they might, well, we're going back to what you said about losing the respect of their peers. Like a whole lot of things. There are a lot of, well, I don't know about a lot, but there might be some very, very good reasons why people choose to ignore it. But as you say, if they do choose to ignore it, well, they are accepting
that's,
it, aren't
that's
they?
That's right. And it comes down to an individual decision, I guess, Narelle. And look, I even though I had a very challenging childhood, my mother raised me with a real moral compass. And I'm probably a little more extreme than a lot, where I just say don't accept it. Having said that, I saw things in Queensland, and I spoke with a trusted colleague about what I should do and who I should report it to. And his firm advice was do nothing, because you don't know who you're dealing with. You don't know if you go to internal investigations or internal affairs, they have colleagues that are corrupt. And it turned out he was right, because when we had our corruption inquiry, a number of senior police who had worked in the internal investigations area went to jail. So, you know, and the threat was real then, and it burned me that I couldn't do anything about it, but I chose to take his advice, because in those days it was quite probable that I would have come home to my rented flat and found an ounce of heroin in my bedside drawer with someone outside waiting to execute a search warrant and lock me up. That, and there were worse things that happened than that, you know.
I'm sure.
But now, you know, we have whistleblower protection. We have most organisations encouraging people to come forward. The other side of the coin, though, that reporting mechanism can be misused. You know, so those who investigate it need to have the skill set to determine truth and bloody vicious allegation and the difference between the two. So it's a vexed one.
Yeah, it is. And I've got to say, from what I've read, I've never had any experience with it myself, but I don't have a lot of confidence with the Whistleblower Act or whatever it's called. It just seems to me that it's still, if somebody does blow the whistle, that they are ostracized.
Yeah.
A lot of them lose their job.
Yeah.
You know, people can make up all sorts of reasons that, it wasn't because they, let's say we use the word lagged, we probably shouldn't. I don't have a lot of confidence in that, but it's the people that run the, what would you call it, the investigations into this.
Workplace misconduct, yeah.
Oh, yeah. God.
Some of them are hopeless.
What a nightmare.
Some of them are hopeless
as
well.
Yeah, you're right.
Yeah.
You're right. And they take the position because it's a promotion,
yep,
but they don't realise what the responsibilities are.
Yep.
And, you know, how they need to protect a whistleblower. It's a big thing to you know, blow the whistle on somebody that everyone else loves, and that often happens, mm-hmm, isn't it? It's the one that everyone reckons is a great bloke or a great woman. Oh, no, she'd never do that.
Roger Rogerson springs to mind, because everyone thought Roger Rogerson was a great detective and a good bloke. You know, so it's a really tough one, Narelle. I guess it's up to the individual to make their mind up, but, you know, yeah, I look back on the challenges it was for me and many, many, many of my honest colleagues to put up with the corruption we saw, because we knew there was nothing we could really do about it. Things have changed.
But also you're talking about, you know, life and death situations with what you saw, and that is just, you know, another level. But, yeah, so your career – as a UC, you talk a lot about, and you were surrounded by guns, both legal and illegal.
Yeah.
You've had a gun pointed to your head. You've nearly ended your life with a gun, your own gun. Mm. So what's your opinion about guns these days? And they just seem to be everywhere in the community. That's a gross generalisation, but there seems to be a huge amount of illegal guns getting into the wrong hands.
Oof,
What do we do, Keith?
There is. I mean, I'll go back a step. Not only had one pointed at me, I've been shot at a few times. So, you know, I, for me, firearms were the tool of my trade. They were also the biggest danger that I faced. And I was only having this conversation literally 2 days ago with some veteran cops. And I went out and had a had a few beers, as you do.
Another 48?
it's all confidential, Narelle. We can't give that away too much. but we're talking about illegal guns, and you know, I reckon, no, I don't reckon, I know, even though I'm not a native of Melbourne, I could, it'd probably give me 2 weeks, I could buy an illegal Glock. I guarantee you I could. I'd know where to go. I'd know what to say. I'd know how to do it. And that's how easily available they are. And, you know, whilst we have shooter's licenses, which I think are great, I do, and this is going to, some people may hate what I'm about to say, but I do have concerns about handguns and their safe storage. I know we have legislation and regulation, but a lot of handguns that hit the black market are stolen from legitimate pistol shooters. They're stolen from home safes. They're stolen from pistol ranges. You know, and you have to go, well, how many of those break-ins are conducted with the knowledge of the pistol owner, if you get my drift?
Yes.
I'm sure that some of them are. And I, you know, you can actually go now. I could go out, go through the whole licensing thing, do my testing, join a pistol club. I could have a 45 caliber Glock with, you know, 8 rounds, which is a pretty awesome handgun, in my safe at home, you know. And so there's that. There's also the fact that, you know, the customs or border force in this country do not have the resources to check every container that comes in, every muscle car that's imported, etc. And again, I'll be careful what I say, but back when I was in criminal intelligence and working on particular organized crime gangs, a lot of firearms were imported exactly that way. And they were imported under the guise of engine parts, machine parts, motorcycle parts, cars, whatever. And it's pretty easy to strip down a Glock particularly, because a great deal of it is polymer plastic. It's not steel. The frame is metal. Mm. But you can hide it in various places, and it will never be picked up by detection. So we've got a whole bloody swag of illegal firearms, not just in Victoria, across the country. You know, you look at seizures that happen in New South Wales, and there, I saw a seizure a couple of weeks ago, submachine guns. I thought, wow, you know, they're still getting them in somehow. The honest answer is I don't know. I think it's just way too late. I don't think we'll ever have an ability in this country to limit the amount of illegal firearms like we'd like to.
I've often thought, because I do a fair bit of research and interviews with victims of domestic violence, police that have been to domestic violence incidents where guns are involved, and I think a lot of domestic violence incidents, I think they'd be, or halved is a big percentage, but I think there would be a lot less if we kept, if police had a safekeeping at police stations, so that you just can't grab a gun if you're pissed off with somebody or you're angry. So you have to go to a police station or somewhere formal to get the gun out, rather than have it at your own house. Is that? Do you reckon that could work?
I think that would be, that'd be a good step, because, you know, if I had a gun at home and lost my mind one night, it's pretty easy to go out, open the safe, load the magazine, and away you go.
That's what I mean.
You know, so, and even there used to be, I don't know, because I'm not in a pistol club, I haven't fired a gun for a long time, but a requirement to keep them at pistol clubs, and then pistol clubs started getting hit. And safes blown and whatever. So, you know, maybe that's not a bad idea. Shooters would hate it, because, you know, and it is a particular removal of rights. But, you know, again, do you take the decision to protect people at the expense of others' rights? Again, you know, one of those really interesting balance questions. But I'll also say, It's not,
no question with me. I should be, anyway.
But
yeah,
also,
go on.
But also say it's not just guns that are used to kill partners. You know, you and I, you and I both know enough knives, blunt instruments, you know, physical violence, all that sort of stuff. So,
Yeah, you're right.
Again, human beings. I think the answer really lies in what's happening a lot now with younger generations being taught respect for relationships with women. You know, and vice versa.
Yes.
And vice versa.
Yeah, true.
Generational change.
And there's another podcast.
Oh, there is, yeah.
We've got a few.
I did warn you. You know, I love to chat about this stuff.
we've got a few in the bank, you know, Keith.
Yeah, we have.
So you're one of Queensland Police's most decorated officers. You've received a number of Valour Awards and Bravery Awards. Is there one? And I'm sure on the night we'll probably touch on this, but is there one which stands out above all the others for any reason?
Yeah. My VA and Bravery Medal for the siege at the MLC building in Brisbane. A very short, people can read about it. Notice the way I'm just shamelessly plugging my book.
You're supposed to be plugging the show, Keith.
Well, we'll be
25th of June.
Yeah, we'll talk about that in a moment. But because I went there with the intention of shooting someone, and I ended up spending time with him and saving his life and my life because he was going to kill both of us. And later, when I gave evidence in the committal proceedings at the Magistrates Court, he stopped me on the way out, shook my hand, and thanked me for saving his life.
Wow.
Vietnam veteran with major PTSD. You know, is there any such thing as minor PTSD? Probably not. So that's the one I'm proudest of, because that for me was a bit of a turning point in my darkness as well. You know, I had a whole, gee whiz, I still had a murderous, angry, bloody attitude towards criminals. I still had that I will shoot anybody when any opportunity arises mentality. When I actually went there with that intention, then spent time with this poor broken man, who by the way had a box of Jellic Knight and a hand grenade and a rifle. But that really is the one I'm most
just
proud
to
of.
Add, yeah. as if it wasn't dangerous enough.
Yeah, that's
oh
right.
My goodness.
That's the one I'm proudest of. Yeah.
Yeah, and so you should be.
Well, thank you.
So, Keith, you've become an avid, very passionate mental health advocate as a result of your personal experiences. And what concerns me is that men are highly represented in statistics regarding mental health. In fact, I quote this often because it's so concerning, that of the approximate 44 people a week who suicide in Australia, 3/4 of them are men.
Mm.
Can you share with us some of the groups you belong to? Because there's very possibly some men out there who are listening, who are struggling, but they don't know where to go or how to take those first steps in seeking some support.
Yeah. Look, first thing I'll say, Narelle, is I've been there. I actually, as you know, I sat in my house one night when I was a younger person, a tactical cop, and I had a pistol in my mouth and thinking about, all I've got to do is squeeze the trigger and all the pain goes away. So I understand it. I really do. So I proudly belong to, first of all, an organisation called the Male Hug. I'm a board member of the Male Hug. We were set up three years ago. We're all volunteers. And our mission is to encourage men to speak before it's too late. So we have a buddy line. So if people want to Google the Male Hug, buddy, there'll be a 1-300 number that comes up, and we actually have a roster of men who will take those calls. And often, you know, someone just wants someone to talk to. More than that, we go out and have a coffee with someone. You know, we stay away from alcohol because that often exacerbates the problem. Unless it's appropriate to have a beer with someone, who the heck knows? But, you know, we are passionate advocates of the mental health space, and I'm the only veteran cop on it. The guys are ranging from business development accountants, guys in the media. We actually have a former AFL Hawthorn player who sits on the board with us, who's been very open about his own struggles. So that's an organisation I'm very proud to be part of. Secondly, Police Veterans Victoria. So PVV started again about 3 years ago, I think. I'm a volunteer peer support officer with police veterans, and we are set up specifically to provide support to police veterans who have anxiety, depression, post-traumatic stress, whatever issues and challenges, to give them the support of their peers. And it's about connecting. One of the biggest things that happens when people leave policing, whether they do it voluntarily or whether they are medically discharged, or sometimes when they retire, often when they retire, is that loss of tribe and that loss of connection. And that's one of the hugest components in recovery, is to understand that you are still part of a group. Where human beings are, we're things that we need company. Yeah, with some exceptions. We really need that. We need to be accepted. We need to have affirmation. We need to feel important. You know, we need to feel wanted. And so with PVV, that's what we do. We have veterans referred to us, or sometimes, like I did last week, I started talking to a guy and realized he was a veteran and he's broken. So I'm encouraging him to let me be his support guy. So I'm very proud of that. I think it's an incredible organization. I know it's life-saving. And part of the other pillar that I have in what I do is I'm an advocate for destigmatizing the conversation around mental health. You know, as you well know, Narelle, the issues of mental health are incredibly widespread, and there are thousands of people out there who struggle. Yeah. But until we can actually say, it's okay to say that you're struggling, it's okay to accept and understand that you have a mental health injury, that's okay, because you're not by yourself. You know, and that is something I could really, really talk about for hours, because I see the benefits. I've personally gone through the journey. I just never thought I'd get out of it, but I have. You know, and as a result, it's like you, it's lived experience. You know, we're in a position where we can absolutely openly talk to people about it, which is one of the things I want to talk about, as well as the stories. One of the things I'd love to have a further chat about on the night of our show.
Oh, beautiful segue, Keith.
There you go.
Beautiful. Now, I'm going to test you here.
Please.
Where is our show?
Oh, God. The National Library, I think.
Oh, you've failed, Dool.
I don't know.
There is another name for the National.
The State Library.
Oh, beautiful. At what time?
7 p.m. sharp, but I'll be there at about 6:30, I reckon. I like to get early.
What date?
The 25th of June.
Oh, you're going well. And one last one.
Go.
Where do you get tickets?
Ah, Eventbrite. I know that one very well.
You passed.
I'm thinking, okay, Keith, why did I say National Library? State Library.
Look, no, thanks, Keith. Thanks very much. I can't wait for the 25th, just to hear how all the intricacies of becoming a UC and some of those, some more of the situations. How many have you got, Keith? Seriously.
Seriously, Narelle, heaps of them. But I am going to talk about one I haven't written about, as well as one that did affect me very deeply. And happy to take any questions from anybody in the audience. And I have to say, no subject is taboo.
No worries. I'll plant a couple of questions for you.
Lovely.
All right, Keith. Thanks again. See you Saturday night, the 25th.
I'm looking forward to it. Thanks, Narelle.
All right.
See ya.
Bye, Keith.
Bye.
Ta-da. Hey, it's Narelle here again. Thanks for listening, and I hope you enjoy the podcasts as much as we enjoy putting them together. But to make sure you never miss an episode of Narelle Fraser Interviews, hit subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And don't forget to leave a rating and even a review. And please share it with all your friends too. And again, thanks for joining us. we have got some amazing stories to tell. So thanks again. See ya. Hello, guess who? Just a quick interruption here to let you know you can now become a Narelle Fraser Interviews Patreon. How exciting! Simply go to www.patreon, that's P for Peter, A-T-R-E-O-N for Narelle.com, and search for Narelle Fraser Interviews. And to all of you out there who continue to support me, thank you so much.